Okay, we're live.
Live here in Montreal.
Okay. So, we want to understand diagnosis. The way the context I'm presenting it to you in part, is substantially a developmental context. We want to know where people are developmentally in terms of culture, in terms of in their own lives. And when it comes to understanding development, there are states and there are stages. States and stages. A stage of development is where you're really at, on average, and then you can experience a lower state or a higher state. So it's quite obvious that as an adult, everyone in this room is at a certain stage of their own development. But under pressure, are you aware, like when you go home to visit your family on Thanksgiving, you can sink to a lower state of development. You can have a lower state experience very quickly. Like you're a mature adult with your own medical practice and you walk in your house and your mother goes, "What'd you do to your hair?" And then all of a sudden you're like 12 years old and responding from... So that would be a lower state. And similarly, you can be at a certain stage of experience of development and have a higher state experience, right? So you go on retreat and all of a sudden you're meditating hours a day and there's spiritual teaching or chanting or whatever there is. Or you just go to like a drumming circle, or you go to a beautiful musical concert, and you hear beautiful music, and you come out and you just feel enlightened, and it raised, like the music or the poetry or the dance, whatever it was, raised you to a higher state. But that higher state's going to fade, and you're going to wind back down at the stage you're actually at. So there are states and stages of development. Piaget, you all know who Piaget was, right? No? French. He's the most significant person in the last century in terms of child development, who laid out all the what are now all the universally recognized stages that children go in development from the moment of birth up through becoming adults. Piaget, P-I-A-G-E-T, right? I think. So he laid out all the different stages of development. So people can get stuck in states, and they can get stuck in stages. They can get stuck in states. The way people get stuck in states is they become addicted to states. Like this fellow who smoked pot every day since 1963. He's addicted to a certain state experience. Addicts are all addicted to states, right? So they're addicted to the state of being on ecstasy, the state of being in heroin, the state of gambling, the state of drinking alcohol, the state of having sex, the state of viewing pornography, as I said, gambling, whatever it is. You understand? They're stuck in a behavior continually trying to engage a state. You can get addicted to the state of meditation, right? You can get addicted to the state of meditation, just withdraw from all of life for the rest of your life and say nothing is real and just go to a cave and you spend the rest of your life meditating and then die because you're just addicted to recreating the state. People get addicted, don't they, to taking workshops? Well, don't they? They just get addicted to learning, so they're in school forever. So you can get but you can get addicted to any of these states at any stage of development, which means you could be an alcoholic in a tribe, or you could be an alcoholic who's a scientist, or an alcoholic who goes to Burning Man, or an alcoholic who studies integral theory. Do you understand? So in any stage of development, you can experience any state. You can get stuck in a stage of development. So the way things work is developmentally, a person is in a stage, and then they any stage of development emerges because it solves certain problems that were inherent in the previous stage. So, for instance, when we were all owned by the king, democracy solved that problem. But then democracy eventually will cause its own problems. Do you understand? And that will have to be solved by something. Right? Something higher. Okay. So you can either, you can be in a stage of development, starting to transcend a stage of development because you're running up against the limitations of that stage. You can start to come into the next stage of development, or you can then be firmly established at that stage of development. When trauma happens to a person, it will fix them, it can have the effect of fixing them wherever they are in relationship to the state they're experiencing at the time or the stage they're experiencing at the time. On a mundane level, I'll give you an example maybe you can relate to. About 18 years ago, I was driving in a car on a highway in Massachusetts, and my car hit black ice. You know what black ice is? And I did six full 360s, hit an 18-wheeler next to me three times, and then the car behind me slammed into my car. Okay, so every time I tell that story, I'm like back in the car spinning. Like, all I have to do is think about that incident, and I'm immediately back in the experience of the car going round and round and round. Do you understand? So a person can experience a trauma of any trauma, right? Having a parent kill another parent, having a brother die and all the commotion in the family, being sexually abused, being raped, being tortured, being abandoned. And there's going to be a state experience associated with it. And the person can get stuck in that state until the proper medicine is applied to remove it. A person can also get stuck at the stage of development they're at. I know a girl who was run over by a car when she was 13, and even though she's a mature woman in her 50s, she is substantially stuck at the level of 13 years old, which means she can function as a 50-year-old, but whenever there's stress, she immediately goes right back to this level. It's always just there beneath the surface, unconsciously motivating her, that she'll become completely unconscious and go into. So we want to note a person's level of development and their state, the state and that they're in, and the stage of development they're in. And we want to look through the life as we take their history and see where the major traumas were, because that can give us a clue as to the states that they're stuck in and the levels of development they may be frozen in. The way development works is, ideally we transcend the weaknesses of previous stages and we include the best that they bring. So what that means is everyone in this room still has the 1-month-old, the 1-year-old, the 2-year-old, the 6-year-old, the 10-year-old, the 13-year-old, the 16-year-old, the 20-year-old in them. They're all still in you. Are you aware of that? You ever get in a fight and someone says you're acting like a 2-year-old? Do you understand? All those states and stages are still there. It's not a problem they're there. We just want to be aware of where a person is stuck because we don't want distortions at any of the previous stages of development. We only want the best of those stages. So if you think of when you're 6 years old and everything is like unicorns and butterflies and the Wizard of Oz and Disney movies, and then you have imaginary friends. Well, the power of that stage is not so different from a tribal level of consciousness that's animistic, where every plant and tree and animal and mountain has a spirit. So that's a very beautiful thing in terms of being in communion with spirit, and in terms of being naive and very open-hearted. But then the downside is superstition, irrational fears, being afraid to be in a room with the light out, always afraid something's under the bed, right? Being afraid, witch hunts are an expression of that level of culture, where the culture will just project all its fears on the irrational few, like with this Ebola outbreak, right? And then you have everybody like scared to death of getting Ebola and getting stocking up on food and getting, and then trying to persecute everybody who's been to an African country. Do you understand? Then it gets totally irrational. You see, so that's the downside. So in any human being, we all have all, not only does everyone in this room have every previous stage of development from the moment they were born to this moment, we all have every stage of human development within us. So the Neanderthal is in there, right? And in some people, you don't have to look very hard to find. Just go to a football game. There was ice hockey on TV at breakfast this morning. You don't have to look very hard to find Neanderthals. But they don't beat each other up at curling competitions, though, so they seem to have gotten a little further. Curling is a higher evolutionary expression. Wouldn't it be great to just see them busted out at a curling match, though, and just start whacking each other with brooms and falling all over the ice? It would be, if in America, if we had curling, it would be more like that, though. So, she says that nobody understands my jokes, but you got that one. She says my jokes don't translate as well, but I guess I know when they're laughing, they get them.
When you relate to hockey, for sure.
Any more hockey jokes?
I don't have that many hockey jokes. That might be my only hockey joke. Okay, so we just want to know, developmentally, where is a person? Where was the insult in their life? What age were they at? And to what degree is that a frozen expression within them? Because all of that can actually be released with medicine. Right? If you just practice good Chinese medicine, as you've learned from Ma Chocha, all of that will be released just practicing what's in that book. But if you don't know how to look for it, then you won't be aware of it when it comes up. Do you see? So if you're practicing any homeopathy, any holistic medicine, all of that will naturally be released. But if you're not aware of it as a practitioner, you can't note it as a therapeutic issue. And when it does come up, you won't be able to gauge, you won't be able to guide your patient through the process and help them become enlightened to understanding the patterns that are coming up and give them feedback as to why that's coming up and how to work with it. But it will all come up, you see, will all, because it's all in there. So when you start making connections with needles and herbs and diet, all that is up. When you move chi and move blood and damp, all of that is going to be released anyway. If you work on the divergent meridians or the windows of the sky, all of that's going to be released. So it's important to know how to work with it. There are two ways to diagnose and treat. For the most part, only one method is taught. And the method that is taught is to diagnose pathology and to match treatment to pathology. So that's the one that everybody knows. I don't have to elaborate it much. But you look at congealed blood, you look at deficient qi, deficient yin, deficient yang, blood stasis, damp stasis, stasis of heat, whatever you're looking at, internal cold, external cold, whatever you're looking at, and you match your treatment to try to release the pathology. And that's totally valid, but it's only one way to work. And the other way to work is to match treatment to the patient, to the virtues of the patient, to the best part of them. So if a patient comes to me and says, whenever I get my, if a woman comes and she says, whenever I have my period, I get very sad and I feel a lot of grief and I feel insomnia, then to match an herb to the pathology, I might pick Wu Wei Zi, Schizandra. But if the woman comes in and says, whenever I get my period, I feel very light and very inspired and very clear, then I might also pick Schizandra. Do you see? Because it also, Schizandra, if you don't know, it would be sort of like lung 7. Sort of like lung 9, lung 7, some combination. So Schizandra treats the lungs. So one person was expressing the pathology of an element, and I chose a formula or points for it. But another person can be expressing the virtue. So a patient could come in on a hot summer's day in August where it's 85% relative humidity, let's say, and very damp out. And the person can say, I'm foggy and I can't think and I just want to lay all day and sleep and I have no energy and I just feel bored. So then I would do points like stomach 40, spleen 6, spleen 8, and give some formula with damp draining herbs, let's say. And I'm matching to the pathology. But a person could come in that time of year and say, I feel completely grounded and totally rooted and very solid, and I just feel so abundant and so nourished. And then I pick stomach 40, whose name is Abundant Splendor. And I pick an herb ginseng because I pick this, I can actually treat with the very same things, but I'm matching it to the virtue, not the pathology. Because I want to reinforce the emergence of the best part of themselves, not just obliterate the worst part of themselves. Do you understand? So this is not taught in schools, for the most part, and it's the whole other half of treatment. So yes, you can treat the illness, but you also treat the soul, the spirit, and the best part of a person. So we have to be able to recognize those two dimensions of the self. When a person's talking to me, the way I'm diagnosing is I'm letting a pattern emerge. And there's a basic fundamental rule of diagnosis, which is also a rule in general of life. And that's if something happens once, it can be an accident, which means have no meaning whatsoever. If it happens twice, it can be a coincidence. But if it happens three times, you've got a pattern. And then you have to start paying attention. So if a patient walks in the door and I write down fire, and I say, how old is your father? And they say, my father died at 51 of a heart attack. That's two times. And if I say, how old is your mother? And they say, 72. And I say, how is her health? And they say, she has hypertension. Well, now we have a pattern established. I said fire, father died of heart attack, mother has hypertension, you see? So this is a general diagnostic principle. When the process of diagnosis is a process of free association, so minimally you're going to free associate according to whatever diagnostic tradition you've been taught. So if you've been taught Zhang Fu, you're free associating with Zhang Fu patterns. If you've been taught eight principle yin yang diagnosis, then you're generating an eight principle syndrome pattern. You're looking for syndrome patterns, right? So if you see a red tip to the tongue and a cleft in the front of the tongue, you know, a little cut in the front of the tongue, and the person has lots of red in their eye, when you look at the eyes, so there's a lot of heat rising. And then the person laughs a lot. And then they say that whenever they have sex, which is fire, they get burning urination. then you're free associating, oh, this person is heat going from the heart to the small intestine venting through the bladder. And you're free associating with all these patterns. So when I'm talking to a person, I'm free associating Zhang Fu, Yin Yang diagnosis, five element, which is color, sound, odor, and emotion. But I'm also free associating, I know the names of all the acupuncture points. So if a person tells me, I just feel like I've been lost in the forest. Oh, gallbladder 40. What's the name of gallbladder 40? Wilderness Mound. Wilderness Mound, like a hill in the forest. So the function of, I know gallbladder 40 is right by the lateral malleolus, right? This bump here. So gallbladder 40 is like going up a hill so you can get perspective around all the trees to see where you've been, where you are, where you're going. So someone says, I just feel lost in a forest. I can't find my way. Oh, gallbladder 40. If somebody says, my spirit just feels like it's buried. I say, oh, kidney 24, spirit burial ground. You see? If they say, I'm just not being nourished by life and I just feel like I'm walking through sludge. I think stomach 40, abundant splendor. So I know the names of all the points and I know the Chinese for them, so I know the meaning of the characters. I know the name of all the herb formulas, right, in the Chinese, so I know what those characters mean. So when a person's talking, I'm thinking names of points, names of characters. I'm thinking of the Chinese language because I know Chinese, so I know the meaning of Chinese characters. So when a person's speaking in English, I'm thinking of all the pictures of the Chinese characters are being triggered for me, and I know what points that names and what herb names that those are associated with. Because I've studied the I Ching all my life, I'm thinking of I Ching hexagrams. And I know what hexagrams they are and what herb formulas and what acupuncture points are associated with different hexagrams. I'm free associating values. So when somebody gives me when somebody is speaking from a place of value, giving me a moral, an ethic, a value that they hold, I know what level of culture they're coming from. Right? So if somebody is really valuing rationality and science and having everything explained to them scientifically, that tells me a lot about what level of culture they're from. If somebody is engaging in magical thinking, I know what level of culture they're from, you see? So I'm looking for the values that are being conveyed in everything the person does and all the actions they take and words they speak. And then I listen to the words that they use, the metaphors they use, the images that are in their language. Those are all very potent in terms of associating them with point names and formula names. So you want to let yourself just free associate. You want to know all the basic theory so well that you can drop it. So that takes a long time. That takes a long time. But you have to know your stuff so well. So you arrive, when you know the theory of Chinese medicine well enough, you reach a point of maturity where you never think about Chinese medicine when you're practicing. I never think about Chinese. I haven't used the word qi in my clinic in 30 years. I don't talk in the language of Chinese medicine to my patients. Some people think that's weird. If I have a guy come replace my dishwasher for me, I don't need him to explain how a capacitor works. Do you understand? I just need him to say, The motor burned out, we're replacing the motor. I don't need to understand the thermodynamics and understand the equation for how the torque on an engine works and have him explain to me how when you place wire and rotate it in the presence of magnets, it generates an electromagnetic field that generates a current. I don't need to know any of that. The way I relate to my patients is, I try to make a connection to them in their own language at the level of their own development that connects for them the relationship between their thoughts, their beliefs, and their behavior. I want to connect their how they think, what they believe, and how they act so that they can understand whatever they're complaining to me about that they say to want they want to be better. I want them to understand it as the natural consequence of how they're thinking, how they're acting, how they're behaving. And I see it as my job of helping them reframe how they think about things. I will tell you that at the level of soul and spirit, the most significant change that can happen in a human being doesn't have to take any time. It may take time for the body to accommodate that change and heal, but it doesn't take any time at the level of consciousness to shift at all. I'll give you an example. My students, just like tomorrow, when I teach my own students, I teach a 2-year course in Massachusetts. People come in for 12 weekends, 6 weekends a year for 2 years, and the whole second year is just seeing patients. It's just seeing patients together. So when I teach my own students, they bring these patients in, and they brought me a patient last month. So this, I was just taking this woman's pulse in a room with her, and I took her pulse, and I stopped taking her pulse, and I looked at her wrist, and I saw a cut coming across the wrist. But it wasn't vertical, and it wasn't horizontal, it was diagonal. So nobody tries to kill themselves diagonally. Well, I've never seen it. When you cut your wrist with razor blades, you either go this way, or if you're really serious, you go this way, but nobody goes this way. So I just looked at it, and she was metal constitution, and her lung pulse was completely empty, like no lung pulse. And there are 3 lung pulses I used, and the main lung pulse that you've all learned our path was gone, and the other 2 were very pathological, showing signs of blood stagnation, which to me meant betrayal. So I looked at this cut coincidentally going right across lung 8 for an inch, and I said, "How'd you get that scar?" And she said, "What scar?" And she looked and she said, "Oh, I had a lot of abuse when I was young." And I said, and she started to cry, and I said, "Well, what's the problem?" She said, "Well, I've done everything I could, and no matter what, I can never be free of this because I can never forgive my father." And I just looked at her and said, "You don't have to forgive him." She goes, "What do you mean?" I said, "To be free of it, you don't have to forgive him. You just have to be free." And it just completely blew her mind, like totally blew her mind, totally changed. She shifted in the moment. And last week, she left a message on my answering machine and just said, she said, "In 40 seconds in your clinic, it totally changed my life after 30 years of trying to overcome this." And she said, "I completely let go of the whole thing, been completely free. And in that space of being free, I've actually found that I can just hold the love that I have for him and let go of everything else." So culture gave her an idea that to be free, you have to forgive. Do you know what religion that's a value in? It's a Christian value. To be redeemed, you must forgive. Okay, that's just a thought. It's not true. So and the problem with it is the mind, which is the part of yourself which will never forgive because it can't imagine, because the mind she's thinking about it with is the mind of the 7-year-old girl who was cut. Do you see? Whose mind isn't sophisticated enough to even embrace what this could mean. So the part of herself that can't forgive was working on forgiving for 30 years. Meanwhile, all I did is put attention on the dimension of herself that nothing ever happened to and talk to her. So all I did is reframe the whole thing. So very often, it's just thinking about things differently is the quickest medicine. And then everything can move therapeutically with needles and herbs. So that is a very important principle. So That's why words, images, metaphors, you want to pay attention to how a person's talking about things, because someone in there, we're all divided. There are two of all of us. One of us is just heart, kidney, soul, spirit. It doesn't have a problem. I'm not talking about the organs. I'm talking about the soul and the spirit. This impersonal dimension of emptiness, infinite emptiness, and an infinite explosion coming out of it. There's no problem in that dimension of the self. That's the dimension of the self that has allowed Nelson Mandela to persevere, Christopher Reeves, you know who he was? The guy who played Superman, who became a quadriplegic. Eli Weissel, do you know who he was? He was in Auschwitz, and he got out of Auschwitz and spent the rest, he's still alive, spent the rest of his life advocating against the Holocaust and against genocide all over the world. So Martin Luther King, Gandhi, this is the dimension of the self that allows people to accomplish truly amazing things in the face of horrific circumstances. And then there's another part of the self which was wounded, which will always be wounded. You don't have to heal that part of the self that was wounded. You have to release the embodiment of it from the body, but at the level of consciousness, all you have to do is introduce the person to the dimension of the cells that never happened to. You see? And you can only do that to the degree that you're aware of that and have embraced that dimension of your own self. Okay? Is that clear? Okay. An operant principle of diagnosis is that patients lie. They deliberately lie. Well, they do. Well, don't they? They deliberately lie, but the human capacity to deceive oneself seems to be infinite. I remember my wife was ordering a dessert. We were out with the family. We were at some birthday party for someone, and there was one of these like horrible cakes that is so much sugar when you bite it, your fillings hurt. You know what? It's just like white flour with a layer of white pasty crust. It's just crap, right? It's like if you ate this, it would have more nutritional. And I was like, "You're going to eat that?" She said, I never have this stuff. And my son spit his drink out on the table laughing because she will eat this whenever it's present in her room. So people have an endless capacity to deceive themselves about their own habits. You ask a patient, how much do you drink? And if a patient says, rarely, that can mean 8 glasses of wine a week. Just because their value is, I have plenty of friends who drink 16 or 24. So I don't drink much because I'm only having 8. Right? That's as much wine as I drink in a year. If you said to a person, how often do you rob a bank? And they said, rarely, only a couple times a month. It would still be a lot. So you have to really get in and get hard details and numbers about things. But people also lie unconsciously because they're actually deluding themselves about, particularly in relationship to that which they have an unwholesome relationship to. You see? That which they have, the more unwholesome the relationship they have to something, the more in denial they are. And that's called a shadow. That's shadow. So shadow is, we have Carl Jung primarily to thank for the realization of shadow. And shadow is the dimension of one's own self that the person is unaware of or will not face that they project onto other people. A perfect example of that now is Bill Cosby. We have, 28 women now, 26, who've come out and said he raped them, right? Probably at least half of them are telling the truth. Maybe all, but at least half, right? And so you can see that in public, his figure was like the most wholesome father, and then behind the scenes, there's this whole other thing going on. And you often see this. So Bill Cosby, there was a time when this beautiful black Bonet, her last name's Bonet.
Lisa.
Lisa Bonet. Beautiful black woman. She had done a nude scene in a movie, and he made a big stink in public to throw her off the show because it was unwholesome and not in keeping with the values of the Cosby Show. Most of you are too young to remember this. So he wanted to throw her off the show, and there was a whole big thing in the media. But meanwhile, he was putting drugging women and sleeping with them. And we see this right in religious figures who go on and on about homosexuality, but you understand, right? This is prevalent. So it's shadow projection. And it comes up diagnostically as this principle. Patients can only ever tell you about themselves. They can't tell you about anyone else. If I say, do you have any siblings? And a patient says, yeah, I have a sister. She's nothing like me. You just say, really, what's she like? And all they're doing is telling you about what their self-image is of how they are. But the thing they hate about their sister is actually a very dominant aspect. It's easier to hate this aspect that they name in the sister than to face that very same structure in their own awareness. And you can be assured it's there. Or if they say, yes, I have a sister and I just love her, we're so close. You just say, well, what's the one thing you love most about her? And then they're telling you not about the sister, but they're really telling you about that dimension of themselves that they have the most care for. It's a very deep principle, very profound principle. The recognition of shadow did not exist in Asian culture prior to Carl Jung. In Asian culture, shadow was spirits and demons. That's the only way it was talked about. And in fact, up until the Communist Revolution, the only way you could get sick in Chinese medicine was through demons. Right? So what are the internal and external causes of disease in the classics? There were the internal and the external demons. And they meant demon. It wasn't a metaphor. Right? You understand? They were at an animistic and a mythic level of development. And when they wrote these texts, they meant demon. So you want to look for the division within a patient. And the other way division shows up is a shadow. Shadow is division. So a patient, we all as human beings have a self-image. The definition of self-image is how you think about yourself and imagine that everyone else in the world thinks about you that way too. So your self-image is your own delusion of how others see you. Do you understand? And, yes, well, you understand that, right? So you want to discover what a person's self-image is. And this kind of shadow is displayed when a person gives you mixed messages in the same sentence. You want to listen for how people contradict themselves. And they can literally contradict themselves over the course of a paragraph or in an hour and a half or two-hour consult. They can say something at one point that totally is diametrically opposed to something they say at another point. But they can do it in one sentence. They can contradict themselves in one sentence. And a classic example would be when you give the patient feedback about what they need to do, and they say, I know what you're saying is true, but, and then everything after the but will contradict it. I used to make the joke saying we're the ones who have to kick butt, which is that we really want to show the person the division, get rid of everything. I know what you're saying is true. If it's true, then you have to act on it. It's a matter of conscience. Do you see? But here are all the reasons I'm not ready to do the right thing yet. People will even say, you're the 40th person who's told me that. Do you see? But I know what you're saying is true because my chiropractor and my psychotherapist and my mother and my preacher and my lawyer all told me. I ran into the Dalai Lama, Buddha, Jesus Christ, and Oprah, and they all said I should do this too. but here's all the reasons I'm not ready. And then everything else after that is just ego. Everything else after that is the disease itself. Talking, whose only investment is to maintain itself.
Okay, but what about like working with the shadow? Like, how long do you give the benefit of the doubt while you know that they're doing something? For example, it's digestion, and you know they're having cake every day, right? Because of the symptoms, things are not really getting better. They might for a day or two. And they'll sit there and keep lying to you every week. And so how do you
detain that? Well, as long as they show up on time.
You don't do that for example, you do six more sessions like that.
I'll do 600 sessions.
And
like
there's no results.
As long as they're showing up and paying me cash money and being polite. But I'm not just colluding with them. I'll give you an example. I started treating a woman in 1986. That was the year I opened my practice in Massachusetts. And she came in the first time and I told her, you're eating far too much junk food. You're eating way too much sweet. And this is going to have severe consequences. You're having way too much fat. It's congesting your liver. Way too much liver cheese stagnation. Way too much heat in your digestive system from your behavior. I told her that in 1986, and in the early 2000s, something was up, and I don't remember what, and I told her, you have to stop doing this. She was basically binge eating, just crap, like literally binge eating, and I said, well, you've gotten this far. I've given you this feedback all along. We're really at a point where your health is now starting to be severely compromised. And if you don't stop this behavior, it's going to go from bad, which it is right now. It wasn't when I met you, but it is now. Had you done what I said when I met you, you probably wouldn't be here. But now that you're here, if you don't stop this, it could be a matter of life and death. And after... from 86 to like 2002, I mean, that's a long time. 16 years, 18 years I treated her. She stopped coming and never saw me again because she wasn't willing to face it. And the next I heard, I got an invitation to her wake. So the thing is, it's not that I'm just going to smile at people. I'm going to be giving them feedback and always offering the opportunity to go deeper.
But she admitted it, right? So I'm talking about the ones who were hiding time and time again.
No, but then I'm very good with pulse diagnosis, you know? And tongue anyway, look, I've been doing this a long time, so a person, routinely I can take a person's pulse and say, you had cocaine in the last 48 hours. Or you just smoked pot, or you had too much sugar this weekend, and people hate it. I have literally gone into restaurants and had people try to hide what they were eating. No, literally. I've walked in restaurants and you see people like shrink down because there's everything on the plate that they shouldn't, that we agreed they weren't going to eat. So I actually had a friend, this is true. I lived near this yoga center called Kripalu, and he was on like a month-long juice fast. And he had gone into town to get ice cream and was driving back to this yoga center. And he got pulled over for speeding and threw the ice cream cone under his seat. Just as a reflex when the light came on. As if the cop would care. But he knew, he felt so guilty about it that he threw the ice cream cone under his seat. Yeah. It actually happened. Anyway, what can you do? I take a person's pulse and I'll just give them feedback. And if they deny it, they deny it. But they know I know. So then they have to lie to really lie. Not only do they have to say I've been good, they have to...
I think that if they deny it, or they don't say it, it's because they know already that what they're doing is wrong. If they didn't know, they would just say it.
That's exactly right.
You would say, oh, that's not right.
So you just...
But they do.
A lot of them don't deny it. They just won't bring it up.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Exactly.
But it's not their responsibility, you know, to
to tell, you could care about them and tell them, but at the end of the day, it's not your responsibility.
Well, that's true, but the way you work, with it is just to let them know that you know that they know that you know, and that's all you can do. And then as long as they come, and you got to earn a living, so. But then you're released because you've been ethical. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink, right? So that's just simply true. Another principle when you're doing diagnosis is to try to ask open-ended questions. If you ask a person, what was the address of the house you grew up in? They're going to say like 17 Mockingbird Lane. That gives you no information. But if you say, where did you grow up? They can say, I never grew up, ha ha ha. They can say, I grew up all over the place. We had to move constantly. You see, then different things are coming through. So try to ask questions in a way that any question provides the opportunity for the patient to reveal the deepest thing going on with them. You want to look for the shift. You want to note the places in diagnosis when you're asking questions where everything just seems to change. You want to note those moments when the person's composure changes, the way they're, if a person's been sitting this the whole time, and then all of a sudden they sit up. If a person's been talking to you like this, and then all of a sudden they break contact. If they've been talking like this, and then all of a sudden they look right at you. You want to note every place in treatment where the change is. And then you want to ask yourself, what just happened? And how? And what syndrome pattern were they expressing? What herb formula? What acupuncture point? What was their color? In Five Element, we do the color around the face, the sound in the voice, the odor, their emotion. We want what emotion was I giving that they responded to? Was I particularly assertive and it made them look away? Or was I particularly assertive and all of a sudden they look at me? Did I challenge one of their values or did I reinforce one of their values? You really want to be aware. There'll be two or three times maybe during a whole intake where all of a sudden just everything shifts. And then you really want to note what happened and what is this they're expressing, because it's really different from what they've been expressing. Do you see? And the two possibilities are they just started expressing the virtue associated with their dysfunction. Rather than the dysfunction, they started expressing the virtue. Or rather than expressing the virtue, they started expressing the dysfunction. And why? In terms of diagnosis, look for the language of victimization. The ego always expresses itself as a victim. The ego is the part of a person born in space and time in the wake of a trauma. And when a person knows themselves only as that, as did this woman I talked about, who I reframed the issue with her father, she only knew herself as the trauma, you see. The problem with that orientation, if you're a therapist with that orientation, just matching your medicine to the trauma, the problem with that is that when you dig down to the deepest part of that part of the person, you're always going to come to a problem. There's an existential dilemma, always, at the root of that self, at the root of the ego. And so when the ego expresses itself externally, it's always going to be as a trauma, as a victim of some trauma. And victimization means that the person is expressing the belief that who they are right now is most significantly the expression of some past cause. That is not the perspective of spirit from the perspective of your soul and from the perspective of spirit, if you're identified, if you have a real relationship with spirit and soul, then who you are is this in any moment is most significantly the self that you are endeavoring to become. In other words, the future has more input into who you are in a moment than the past. Do you understand? The future has more input into who you are in any given moment than the past. That's what we'd like to shift things to. We want every person to shift from being identified with a victim of their past to the spontaneous creator of a better future by just striving to be a better person and actually being that person now, not waiting to the future to be that person, but actually being the person they wish they could be now. That's how I know my patients are getting better at a deeper level, is when I see that fundamental shift. Victimization can be very, it can be not so subtle. Aren't we all aware of not so subtle victimization? Right? But it can be very subtle. Say, I would like you to take 3 capsules of this herb formula 3 times a day. And the patient says, okay, I'll try. What is that? I'll try? What does that mean? Would people tie you up 14 hours a day and keep you from your herb cabinet? Right? So that's victimization. When a patient says, I can't, that really means I won't. I'm writing a dictionary as part of my new book. So, I can't means I won't. I couldn't means I didn't. Okay? So the ego is always trying to use past failure as proof that you can't succeed in the present. Right? Well, I'm coming for weight loss, but I don't really see what the point is, because in the past, I couldn't stay on any diet I was on. It's not couldn't, it's that you didn't. That the fact that you didn't because you didn't want to doesn't mean you can't now if you do want to. You see? When a patient says they're stuck, they say, I just feel stuck. Stuck is just a feeling. Consciousness isn't stuck. Consciousness is an unbroken field in the whole universe. The part of themselves that knows they're stuck isn't stuck. Do you see? Mm-hmm. When a patient says they're confused, they're never confused. Okay? So, this is a very important point. If you can say I'm confused, the part of you that can see you're confused isn't confused. It's the part of you that's aware that there's confusion in its experience. Usually what people mean when they say I'm confused is my ego wants to do this, but my spirit wants to do that. My conscience is telling me to do this, and I'm not ready at a point where I'm willing to choose between what my ego wants and what my conscience, soul, and spirit wants. It's so confusing. I know that I'm married and I took a vow and I said I wouldn't cheat, but my ego really wants to do this. I know that I said I'm going on a diet, but my ego really wants to fudge. It's so confusing. Do you see? So the person is stuck between these two parts of themselves and they're not willing to take a stand for it. People who are confused are the people who think they're not confused and everybody else knows they're crazy. That's a confused person. The guy who came in this morning, he was confused. Now, from his point of view, he's the sane one and we're all crazy. Do you understand? And if I went to him and I said, sir, actually, we're having a class here, you're being invasive, you're inappropriate, it seems to me that you haven't been taking your psychiatric meds, maybe you should call your doctor. He would probably get very belligerent and tell me all the way I was wrong. And then if I said, I want everyone in here to raise their hands, which one of us do you think is right? And if 17 people said I was right and nobody said he was right, he would say, you're all crazy. But if he came in, if he had looked at us this morning and said, you know, I'm really confused, that would be a helpful prognosis. Then you could work with that. Well, this is a very important principle in life generally. What time is it? We are rocking. I'm going to actually finish by noon, or five after anyway, and then we can have lunch. And okay, we want to know who is talking to us. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What's your name?
Catherine,
yeah. Well, yes, yes, with the caveat. Do you know what caveat means? Warning. With the provision, provision to you, that knowing what to do with a patient and when, and knowing what to tell them, and when the right time to tell them that, has to do with striving toward. You have to stay right there because she asked the question and you keep moving. No, it's all right. Just for a moment, you're good now. So what this question gets to, what is the actual balance between truth and compassion? Which is something that a person on a spiritual path will learn about for eternity. So the truth without compassion can be very cruel. And if you tell the person the truth, at a time they're not genuinely ready to hear it, that lacks compassion, and then it can just be hurtful. For instance, I remember when I was going through, just very recently after, when I was separating from my first wife, when we were going through a divorce, and I was at a point of great pain, and it was just like 4 days after she left, I had two friends look at me and say, you're going to meet someone you're much happier with, and you probably know them already, and you'll be happier than you can ever imagine. That was true. But telling me that 72 hours after my wife, well, I had no ears to hear it, and there was just nothing in me that could take it in, and it actually just made me shut down, because there was no part of myself at that point I was identified with that was bigger than my own suffering, you see? So the truth without compassion can be harmful. But compassion with no truth is just collusion. Just holding people's hands, telling them they're perfect as they are, not challenging them at all, and just helping them feel always comfortable where they are without ever trying to bring them along is just collusion. That's just spa level therapy. It's not even therapy. It's just a spa treatment. Well, it is. No, that's not medicine. That's just doing spa work. Do you understand? So we strive for the perfect balance of truth and compassion, and I've been in full-time practice 30 years, and I still learn every week a little more subtly about the timing of things. If you practice in a right way, you'll be able to reach people more deeply quicker on average with just the right intervention. And the same thing, by the way, goes for needles. Like when you first start practicing, you might feel compelled to do 20, 30, 40 needles. It's true. But the time you're practicing 30 years, if you're paying attention, I mean, I can use on average in a treatment 7, 8 needles is an average treatment that I give people. It's really, and 12 or 15 is a really, really, really big treatment for me. And the number of points I use on the body has gone from all the points down to a much smaller subset. And the actual protocol, I've developed all my own patterns that I've found have worked for me over time. And if you saw me treating, you'd go, God, he's just using a few things. But if you watched over time, you'd say, God, but people are getting better. And I think this is true of all people in all traditions. I tend to notice that as you practice longer, you fewer herb formulas, fewer additions, simpler. You look at the Chinese herb formulas, and there's the whole friggin' Materia Medica. You have 27 herbs in a formula. You look at a master practitioner. My practitioner is one of the great herbalists alive, and his herbs, when I parse it out, there's 6 or 8 herbs in a formula. They're very simple formulas. But when I was going to a TCM physician for years, I mean, the formulas, you parse it out, there'd be 24 friggin' herbs on the table that I divided all out to see what he was giving me. So the better you are, the smaller, the less, the more you can just convey with just a look, just a dimension of how you're being with the person. We want to know who it is we're talking to. Is it the ego? Is it the authentic self? The authentic self is the best part, and this is a term from Chinese medicine, it's just Zheng Qi, is the true Qi, the authentic self. The best part of the person is only ever concerned with responding to things as they are now in a way that makes them better. And the ego is the part of the person that responds in a way that makes them worse. Even if it's just preserving the status quo, that's going to make things worse, because it's preserving the circumstances that have given rise to the problem. You understand? So you want to know which part of the self the person's expressing from. You also want to know who you're talking to. If you say to a person, I'd like you to go off gluten, and they say, you don't understand, bread is food. It's not a human being talking, that's just the bacteria in their large intestine and small intestine. I'm serious. It's just the hungry po spirits in the small intestine, large intestine, that are generating cravings that create, that lead the person to eat in a way that creates a hospitable environment for the bacteria to thrive. Do you all know what the herb cordyceps is? It's a bacteria. It's a fungus, and it gets into this caterpillar that makes the caterpillar climb to the topmost branches into exactly the kind of environment that the fungus can grow in. Or maybe not the topmost, maybe the inner branches of the tree away, so it's really shaded, so the fungus can grow. And then the fungus grows in the caterpillar and grows out of its head, and the caterpillar dies. And the fungus has a new host. Do you see? Okay. So when people are eating lots of white food, the character for Po, Po is the spirit of the lungs and the intestines. The character for Po is the character for demon, devil, with the character for white next to it. And when a person's eating lots of sugar and the bacteria in the intestines get all out of balance, they start craving white food, which is sugar, milk, sugar and dairy, pasta, rice, potatoes, bread. And then that generates cravings for the carbohydrates, and it generates cravings through what's called the brain-gut axis. And the person identifies and thinks, I'm craving this. I'm craving it, and then they eat it because they're craving it. Do you understand? And then when you tell them, I want you to stop eating this food, the bacteria in their colon speak through their mouth and say, I can't, bread is food. Do you see? But it's not the human being. Because the person who came to you to get better, the soul and the conscience and the spirit, will do anything it takes to get better, no matter how large the sacrifice, not for themselves, but for everyone else in their life that they feel responsible to. Do you understand? Okay. So you want to know who you're talking to. You want to speak to the patient in their own language with images that are meaningful to them. I said this before. How much hope do they have about their situation? very important part of diagnosis is to what degree can the person imagine a better situation for themselves. If I ask every patient, what do you do for a living? If a patient doesn't like their career, I will always ask, what would you rather do? And if there's nothing else they'd rather do, the prognosis isn't as good as saying, well, I'd rather do X, Y, Z. And then if the patient says they'd rather do X, Y, Z, then I want to see, have they been making any plans to do it? And if they say, yes, well, I've been slowly taking a course. I can only do one course each semester, but I'm getting the prerequisites. Well, then they're on the path, and there's hope, and there's light at the end of the tunnel, you see? And then everything is good. But if they can't conceive of a better future, then we know it's all ego, because the future isn't any input into creating who they are. Do you see? They're just defined by their past or limited by their present circumstance. So this is very important. And the last thing I'll say, which I said before, is in conclusion, we want to make a connection between what the patient is complaining about, how they think, what they believe, and how they behave. Because we want them to reframe for them all the dysfunctional ways they're thinking. We want to help them evolve at the level of belief so they can believe in higher things than the values that have caused the problem they have. And we're going to have to start by getting them to at least start behaving as though they actually believe what they believe, which means if they're a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a Burning Man guy, right, a Montreal Grateful Dead hippie, whatever they are, they have to start living up to that before we can really start introducing. If they're not living up to what they profess to believe in, we can talk philosophy all day long of them. They're not going to live up to anything higher. And ultimately, we want to see the proof that treatment's working in the change of behavior. There are two ways to practice medicine. The first way is the way most people practice. The way most people practice is they try to use medicine to help people get to the point, help their patients get to the point where they feel like doing the right thing. I much prefer to practice medicine by having my patients start doing the right thing and then use the medicine to deal with the consequences of having done it. Do you understand? I'd much rather have a patient come in, stop smoking, and use acupuncture to treat everything they're going through when they stop smoking than to spend the next 3 years getting them to the point of feeling like stopping smoking. Now, sometimes you have to do that. Sometimes you have to, because that's who the patient is. But my preference is always to encourage people to make the change now and let's deal with the consequences, rather than let's spend a long, long time getting you to the point where you finally feel like doing the right thing. Okay, that's the morning lecture. Any questions? Yeah.
And you said four things that you want to make a connection with when you're a patient. You said what the patient is saying, what the patient is believing.
And how they behave. Oh, you make a connection between what they're complaining about. So you have to motivate them. So presumably what they're complaining about represents their motivation for coming. I want my shoulder to get better. Okay, then you have to stop playing rugby. Do you see? I want my hip pain to get better. Then you can't run 80 miles a week. But I believe that running 80 miles a week is healthy. So you have to make a... And if I don't run 80 miles a week, I get very emotional. So you have to make a connection between their thoughts, their beliefs, their behavior, and what it is they say they're coming for, so they can see that changing their thinking, changing their beliefs, and changing their behavior is what's going to create the largest context for getting better. And that really is true. Isn't it true? No matter how good our medicine is or anyone's medicine in the world is, if a patient keeps doing and living in the same way, they're going to keep what they've been doing, then they're living in the same context that gave rise to the problem, so it's going to keep generating it. So then, if they're not going to make any changes, and even if our medicine's very strong, if they keep living in the same way, even if we take care of the symptom, we know that the dysfunctional way they're thinking, believing, and behaving is going to lead to a more significant symptom down the road. Do you see? It's going to lead to a bigger problem down the road. Any other questions before we break? Okay. Bon appetit.